It's Sunday, which means it's time for Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns. Each week, we bring you the top global and national news stories presented with facts and top-tier analysis, all from a perspective rooted in America's founding principles. Join us in defending our great nation and American liberty. Now, here's Malcolm and Michael with the week's top stories.
Well, number 46, Joe Biden, the presidency. Kind of that surreal moment we've been talking about for a while. Doesn't almost seem possible. And the thing that I've been wondering quite a bit, and probably you have as well, for real now, that stack of executive orders on the desk there, you know what I mean? All in the leather-bound books, and they look very pleasant, they go up as high, sky high as they can. Does he really know what he's signing? Does anybody really think he does, I wonder? You know, we've had a lot of talk and a lot of conversation about Joe Biden, whether he was the puppet or not. I mean, who's really questioning that? I mean, does everybody, and really his followers, I mean, I assume he has a handful anyways, but whoever they are, do you think they think that he knows, or are they all sort of in denial? You know, I'm wondering. Because, you know, these executive orders didn't happen overnight. They've been planned. And these things take time to put together, the language and what you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, so you think of that and you think of all the people in the back room. It's a visual you can almost guess. It's almost like a Chinese factory. You know, the China factories where they make the Apple products and stuff, you know, and they're all working there slaving. And it's kind of what they have there with Biden's executive orders. That's it. That's what it looks like. Wow, wow, wow. Well, welcome to Viewpoint Presents, my fellow Americans. This is Malcolm, along with Michael Johns. And Michael, Michael, Michael. It's almost like the wow, yeah. Wow, wow. It's almost like the wow, wow, wow. Michael, Michael, Michael. Can you believe this moment?
You know, it's I'm noticing a range of literally psychological and emotional reactions from people all over the political spectrum across this country. A lot of people confide in me about how they feel about these things. And the one of the obvious takeaways, which reminds me a lot of what I thought I felt and saw in 2009, January 2009, when Obama came in, was, you know, really extreme anxiety and, you know, on the left, maybe a little bit of excitement, or at least they're just happy to see Orange Man bad gone, and a lot of confusion. And, you know, it's a range of emotions out there, and people are definitely, they're not glued in or excited, but they are thinking about what's going on. But, you know, Malcolm, before we start today, this profession of ours doesn't have many icons, really, but it has had a few. And we lost one today. I went to the University of Miami and, the late 80s, mid to late 80s, and he had started his radio career there. And I used to run into people in Miami Beach, older people a lot of times, and I worked briefly in radio down there with the WNWS news station. And Larry King, who rose to radio fame and then was a really mainstream, well-received television talk show host on CNN and then other networks, Fox Business for a while, always seemed ahead of the curve, always just seemed like that guy who was going to be there no matter what happened, all through all the heart attacks, the however many marriages and divorces. And I always found him, I'm quite confident he wouldn't agree with us on a lot of issues. I'm not under any illusions about that. But he brings you back to a period in media where, you know, he was balanced and fair and conversational and generally upbeat and friendly. And you felt like whoever he was interviewing, whatever their perspectives, whatever their profession, he was able to draw the best out of them. And I think he's got to go down as one of the greats in American broadcasting. Mm. And I will never forget running into these older people in Miami Beach before they built out South Beach when I was down there, who would just religiously catch his show. I mean, they just would not even want to miss one episode. Yeah. That's the kind of captivating, engaging relationship he developed with his audience. And I have to say, I think, you know, the totality of his career is utterly impressive. And, you know, I hope some media figures will pause today and look at what they think they're doing.
Well, listen, he was 87. I think he was married, I think eight times, I believe. Could be nine, but I think it was eight. And but 87, remarkable life for sure. And, you know, and of course, he just passed away yesterday on Saturday. So, and, you know, here we are. And I'm glad you brought it up because, you know, Larry King, he was a conversationist. He was a very good interviewer. He knew how to throw the questions and he'd always step back. And of course, he had his trademark look. And, you know, I have to tell you, I was thinking about him recently. In fact, I tell you, Michael, I was thinking in recent months here that I'd love to interview the man. And I always think about that with some of the old timers because I find them such a piece of history. But Larry, in my view, was more of a centrist. He was from an old era that you just don't see anymore. More of a centrist. And he didn't really wear it on his sleeves.
Yeah, I don't really think he viewed it as his role to project what his view, whatever viewpoints he held, that kind of came through that. I just don't even think that was a mission that he would have considered. Whereas you know, Jake Tapper, that's his main mission.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking back to just recent times, and I'm telling you, I swear to you, this is what I was really, this is before this just happened in the last day here. But what I was thinking recently is, you know, CNN has gone so far off the rails. And we all remember back to the CNN days with Larry King. This is before they got really started smelling the glue, Michael, you know. This is before those days. And you think of CNN back in that day, when, you know, you could see it at the airports and still stomach it. And you think of Larry King up there and he was a different kind of character. And I was thinking recently and I thought to myself, why don't they bring like him back or something? Because their programming absolutely sucks with a capital S.
He wouldn't fit in there.
Of course not. Of course not. But I thought, boy, wouldn't that be a step in the right direction? A guy like a Larry King, you know? And I really thought that not too long ago. Anyways.
Well, you know, CNN called me the night of the inauguration, looking for my input on Biden's speech and really some specific components of it too. And I gave them a whole bunch of good things and then nothing appeared, which was kind of curious. And I, you know, with all of the Project Veritas and all the other stuff that's come out on them, you always kind of wonder what they're up to. And you know, are they just feeding stuff like literally to the Dems as they have?
Well, it depends what you say. It depends what you say.
But the fact that a thought like that even goes through your head suggests how far off the rails they've gotten. Yeah. And did you happen to hear the description of the Biden inauguration by their political director, where he described the lights as Biden's arms extending and whatnot? I'm going to have to send you this because you're going to want to play this on the air. It's comical. I mean, it's like I guess it takes you back to Chris Matthews and the tingle going up the leg when he heard Obama speak or whatever that phrase was.
Well, he referenced he was embracing all of America with his hands arching the lights in Washington, D.C. I mean, it was a spectacle, the whole thing. Right, the whole inauguration.
Nothing to do with those lights.
Well, I can tell you a couple of things they could do with them, but maybe they could shine some light up their backside and figure out what the hell they're doing. Let's get into that a little bit, will you? Biden inauguration. So I started talking about all these EOs he had on the desk. And you know, a lot of people have asked me in recent times, questioning me, does he know what he's signing? I mean, these are legitimate questions and legitimate people asking, does he have any clue? And, you know, we're just getting revved up here in the Biden administration. It's hard to say that in, like I said, consecutive words or even the words president and Biden in the same sentence. But yet we're saying it, or we got to say it somehow, I guess, at least for the moment.
For the moment.
And that's how I am. I'm looking. No, you just said it. I think you and I would agree. We look at this as a momentarily pause. We hope and pray, because if we don't get off of this, we're going to be in a heap of trouble.
I just don't feel I don't have an instinctual good feel that he's a 4-year president.
Exactly. He's not, Michael. He's not. Absolutely not. He's not. He's not. He's not. He's not going to make 4 years. Michael, I don't even think he's making 2.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you never know, but
I think he's going to blow up.
There's a bunch of factors. There's a bunch of factors here. And some of them I've just observed over the last couple of days, which we can
They're going to turn on him quickly. Here's what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
You can smell it already coming. They're going to turn on him quickly because this guy, now for real, his policies are whacked out, but the guy is completely out to lunch. And what's going to happen is he's going to keep going back to his old standby. What's that? He said it in the one thing at the desk there. Give me a break, man. I mean, that's the thing.
Come on, man.
Right. That's it. Yeah, come on, man. It's like, what the? Can I ask you a question, Michael? Does that sound presidential to you?
No. Look, you and I raised nothing but reservations about this guy for the last 6 months. But I have to say, we did it authentically. I mean, you know, obviously we both went out and voted for Trump, you know, just news alert to our audience.
I voted 10 times for Trump, by the way.
The Democrat way,
10 times, Michael, you know?
I had a mask. I had a mask on, special pens in hand, all kinds of procedures. But I've never missed a general election in my life, so I'm proud of that. And I was more than proud to cast that vote for President Trump. But let me, you know, just say, I mean, this is living up to all worst expectations so far. I mean, let's just start, if we could, with the actual event, right? So for 2 months, you've known that these inaugurations are a pretty big deal. You've been in politics for 47 years. You've been to a bunch of them. You know, they kind of set the temperament for an administration, and you want to have a good one, right? What makes a good inauguration? Well, by the way, I was down for Trump's inauguration speech. I can remember it starting to rain right when it started. And there was violence in the city that day.
A lot of radical protesters.
I took my son. I mean, he's now 23, but he was whatever back then, 19. I mean, it was vulgar. I mean, you know, there was vulgarity everywhere. And we were all over the city that day too, not just at the inauguration. But I just look at this and, you know, I start with the fact that you got to be kidding me. You have drawn 1,000 people to an inauguration. And I mean, this is important because in the back of the minds of 47% of the country, as you and I have been talking about exhaustively, and it's not even in the back of our minds, it's in the forefront of our minds. We got legitimate concerns about how this election went and the fact that this guy really received 82 million votes. I mean, it's very hard to fathom that 82 million of my fellow Americans looked at the options and, you know, put their money down on this guy to the tune of 82 million. So, you know, if you're on that side, and I tried to think about it from that perspective, Malcolm, I said, you know, if I'm on the other side and I'm trying to like put this issue to bed, one of the many, I would do many things that they haven't done, but one of the things I would want to do would be to have a really large and successful inauguration that showed at least some level of considerable enthusiasm for the fact that this guy's been elected. Mm-hmm. And then you just looked at this and, you know, here's this guy literally cannot attract a crowd. Now they blame it all on COVID proactively, saying, hey, with COVID, we can't bring anybody down there. But as you and I've talked about, Trump said two rallies in D.C. just down the street over the last 7 or 8 weeks. One was 400,000 or 500,000 on the 6th, and the other one back in November was a million people who came from all over the country to hear Trump on the 6th. And I'm not even sure back in November if Trump even spoke. Mm-hmm. But because of their passion around his presidency, what they thought he offered the country, you can't get, and you get to figure like what percentage of that population are, you know, relatives, friends, political consultants, you know, I mean, like literally the American people were unrepresented at this event, you know, and you could bring Lady Gaga out and you can bring out like all of the entertainment figures that travel with the left. It didn't change the fact that you just looked at this and said, this does not look right. And then on top of it, to have 25,000 military personnel deployed around that city, that is, in terms of a city the size of Washington, an extraordinary military presence. which would actually be okay if you were offering some explanation as to what the credible threat was.
Right.
But we got no statement again out of this, out of the Pentagon or the Justice Department about what, I mean, so it was kind of at the aura of a, you know, what you would see in the autocratic totalitarian world. Mm-hmm. It's like a military occupation, a head of state with no inspirational words or any enthusiasm from the people. The applause sounded like, oh, I don't know, a middle school play that was going so-so at the encore time, you know, where the parents sort of feel obligated to have the soft applause. Mm-hmm.
So what I take from all of that actually is very alarming, but it's like the elites were in charge and the elites were in control of the invitation list. And they were certainly in control of the conversation and the appearances to whoever was watching around the world. And when you look at, you know, I thought a lot about that inauguration with the barbed wire and the fences and the National Guards and the troops and the conversation and the awkwardness. And I thought to myself, Michael, like, is this what they call the peaceful transfer of power? Is this what this looks like? I wonder. I wonder, is it the peace? Is it? I mean, that's a legit. Now, let's look at that a minute here. When you look at all the things we've been talking about, and I'm not a theorist, but let's just get into it. So what's, I mean, let me just ask you. I mean, it's a real question. Does your gut, does your heart tell you that this in every way, sense and probability that this was indeed the peaceful transfer of power? Did it feel that way to you?
I've told everyone to avoid speculation on that for the purposes of getting to the bottom of the fraud and the procedural violations. But to answer the question, no. I felt like, I felt, firstly, it was, everyone has their own emotional reaction. And the closer you are and the more involved you are, I assume the more strongly you feel those emotions. But it was a sad day for me. I looked at it and I said, I can't with a straight face say seriously and definitively that we're swearing in the right man, which I said I thought was immensely dangerous to the present and future tense of American representative democracy. And I thought we were saying goodbye in a very underwhelming way to a president who did a very good job over 4 years and with just about every conceivable opposition and problem thrown at him unnecessarily that you could imagine.
A consequential president is what he was. A consequential president who didn't speak their language, Michael. He didn't speak their language. And they never accepted him into the club, did they?
That was part of it. A lot at work here. But to see, let me just take one part of it that you may or may not have thought of. To see him having to depart Joint Base Andrews to Frank Sinatra's My Way, and no Mitch McConnell, no Kevin McCarthy.
I talked about this. Yeah.
And no Mike Pence. Are you kidding me?
That's it. I talked about it on air. That's exactly it.
If I have to remind you, you go back to when Pence was selected. I can remember when Trump went out to Indiana to meet with him. He was down in his reelection campaign 5 points or so in that Indiana gubernatorial race. Now, maybe he would have come back, but it's certainly no stretch to say that Donald Trump saved the political career of Mike Pence. And not only that, he put up with ultimately a very questionable constitutional decision made unilaterally on the electors that was just a few weeks ago. You are not at the president's side when you bid goodbye after this tumultuous, hard-fought, grueling battle. We had all these extraordinary accomplishments, record economic productivity, restored confidence in America around the world, strength, and you know, it just, that to me just seems like it was owed almost a comment. You might as well have just said, yeah, I'm stabbing him in the back and moving on. I mean, clearly that's what he was doing. And Mike Pence is a guy who's held in very high esteem by particularly Washington, D.C. conservatives because he spent a lot of time with them. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to hear any defense of that. I don't care what you think of Trump. When you you served in that role because of him, because he won that election and he chose you as his running mate. Mm-hmm. And he gave you an extraordinary historic opportunity that you were fortunate to have. And you don't have the decency to take the ride up to Joint Base Andrews and bid him farewell after all this.
Well, what I took out of that is somehow McCarthy, McConnell, and Pence, somehow in their warped minds, they were thinking, I believe, that they had to be at the inauguration for the betterment of what, the political class? Or did they think they were doing it for the American people? Maybe, yeah,
you gotta,
I don't
think,
know.
Pretty deeply, I'm going to speculate here. I think, look, those guys, if you ask them, did they feel more powerful in their respective positions with Trump in the Oval Office or with Biden there? I think they feel more powerful now. So yeah, they're more senior Republicans. I mean,
interesting.
You know, so a lot of people don't think about it in those terms. But a guy like Mitch McConnell, you know, he now is like, hey, I'm the main guy in this party in town. I was playing second fiddle and having to do what Trump told me to do before. So plus the other thing that is,
yeah, but how's he empowered now? He's now Chuck Schumer's bitch. How's he empowered now?
Well, I think we underestimate that relationship. I think those guys are actually pretty close. I think they have some disagreements, but they're not substantial ones. And this is the way I described it in media this week, which was kind of just, I don't know, I've always thought this, but it kind of occurred to me in a more prominent way. You've heard me talk about how there's too much power in congressional leadership. And that's a problem because it diminishes all these other people that are elected to represent their districts. They don't get to do what they could do or think what they could think or come up with innovative ideas. It's too much top-down micromanagement. But you say these four guys, okay, so you take McCarthy and you take Pelosi, Schumer, and McConnell, and you say, if you took these guys out of Congress and you were like an executive recruitment firm, or you were like a McKinsey management consultant or something, where would they be most successful elsewhere in the world? And I started to think about that. And I said, you know, it would be like in fundraising. These guys are fundraisers. Hmm. They're money people. Hmm. They know how to raise money. They're incredibly successful in raising money and using positional authority to leverage that money.
Well, they're salespeople. They're salespeople. They know how to sell. They would be great salespeople for sure.
A specific genre of sales.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, with McCarthy and McConnell and Schumer, that special relationship you were just talking about, let me ask you a question. Do you think they're more Debacans or Republicrats? Which one are they?
I think they're both driven by donor interests. I can testament. I used to sit in meetings when I worked in the Senate with Mitch McConnell. There was a caucus meeting we had of several right leaning conservative Republicans that would talk about strategy, and they were, I think I talk about this now, they were then complaining about kind of the way we complain about the situation now, about the leadership that existed there and how they weren't embracing conservative ideas. They weren't idea-based enough, and they weren't politically sophisticated. I mean, they were trying to figure this stuff out as kind of the second tier of leadership in the Senate. And at that time, if you had asked me, hey, what do you think of this Mitch McConnell guy from Kentucky? I would have said, he's one of the better senators we have. He's like a movement conservative. He's looks at the world the way we do. Mm-hmm. Inside, my observation was that he was immensely political and poll-driven person, focused on the operations of politics more than the ideas. And over time, once he ascended into leadership, and this just seems to be happen over and over and over and over again until we fix it, you would hear, you look at what are the motivating forces driving them. It's not representing their states. That's pretty clear. It's not really listening to the people as a whole. That's pretty clear. It's these relationships they have with large industry-based special interests, unions, major global forces that drive all of the money that needs to be raised to keep this system going. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, just look at this 2020 cycle and how much money was spent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah, one of the, I did have a takeaway, however, some that I think the American people will be hopefully concerned with, Malcolm, and that is that I've heard throughout the week, and particularly yesterday and today, about a number of well-meaning individuals who went down to Washington, D.C. on January 6th to hear the President of the United States speak. Seems like a great opportunity. I've been so close to it that I sometimes take it for granted. But, you know, if you have an opportunity to hear the President of the United States speak, I don't care who it is, you should go do it. I took my son when he was a little kid out to meet Bill Clinton, and, you know, it's no Clinton fan, but you know, there aren't too many of these guys, 46 exactly, as you said. Anyway, they got back from hearing the speech at the Ellipse and were some of them were confronted by employers about participating in a, you know, what they were calling a terrorist event. You know, and these people pretty uniformly said, hey, yeah, look, there was like, you know, a few dozen, a few hundred people in this event of hundreds of thousands who definitely were off doing something else at a different location. But I was there for a peaceful event. I sat and listened to a speech. I got back on a bus and I went home and had no role in that. Didn't know anybody who was involved in it. Don't know anybody who was part of it. Don't support it. Not a suspect in anything. And were terminated from their jobs as a result of going to see President Trump's speech at the Ellipse, which got me thinking, because you and I have talked about how this economy is just like media, like entertainment in Hollywood, like academia, increasingly politicized. I mean, it used to be that you go back to like the 50s and 60s, the general feeling of big companies was get people involved, you know, and it doesn't matter what they're doing ideologically. If they've got some political clout in the community or nationally, it's only helpful to any company, right? So in the old world, if you had an opportunity to go and build some political relationships, hear a president speak, most companies would thank you for doing that and think it's a positive thing. Well, not in the Trump era and not in the cancel culture era. And which got me thinking to, you know, really about Shop to the Right, our new sponsor on Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns, and the fact that these guys, straight out of the city of my birth, Allentown, Pennsylvania, are developing what I think might represent the future of commerce in this country, where values and ideals, which were just sort of taken for granted or not even thought of historically, are now going to be at the forefront of considerations as it relates to consumer choices. And now, you know, people make, you know, consumer choices, numerous ones, usually in any given day. They're not ones that have usually been based on geographic proximity, you know, convenience and price, right? Those have been the driving forces usually. Yeah. Kind of the five P's of marketing. But I think we're seeing this economy evolve in a way where what companies stand for and what they are in fact associated with is becoming a factor. I can't describe the larger development as a positive one. I wish it weren't that way, but we'd be foolish in 2021 not to acknowledge the obvious reality of that. So Shop to the Right, who you have spoken with, and I have now actually had a chance to speak with briefly at least as well, are up to some really exciting things. And they've partnered with America Out Loud. They've developed a blossoming website, shoptotheright.com, which is doing a good job in both developing businesses and services and products that are manufactured by individuals who support the country and its founding principles and its reject the radical violence that we've seen on the left and some of these more dangerous impulses that we see on the left that have manifested in some of the larger Fortune 500 companies. And what it does is really afford an opportunity now for consumers who don't like seeing their money redirected to these radical causes to go off and purchase them from their fellow Americans who share their views and values. And that's a great, great service. And so, you know, there's two action items here. One is that if you own a company of any sort, or even if you're a sole proprietor providing any service or product, you can sign up for free with shoptotheright.com and make your services available to those, the vast majority of Americans who share this vision and outlook that the United States is a pretty special place. And then, of course, if you're a consumer looking for any services or products, their list of offerings is growing by the day. And that's an extraordinarily great opportunity for individuals to get away from, you know, say Amazon.com, which put $10 million into that street violence and never apologized for it.
I'm going to suggest to you all that, like Michael's saying, with Shop to the Right, I really believe, and I want to get behind these kinds of groups, because I believe this is where it's going to be fought, Michael, is the grassroots movements now. And money talks, money talks. And, you know, the kinds of things we're talking about right now, it's so imperative. So let me leave you with that thought. ShopToTheRight.com. You folks need to get behind this movement. This is basically a group of patriotic people. There are some veterans that founded the group that recognize that a lot of the companies and players that we're doing business with, they're funding violence, they're funding vandalism, they're funding overseas adversaries and enemies, and that's where the money is going. And so, like, if you turn the lights on, you kind of see all this, and then you got to say, well, how do we support American values? And that's kind of at the center of this storm right now, with everything that's happening in our country.
You know what
I
really liked, Malcolm? In my brief conversation this week, I speak to entrepreneurs all the time, and you have as well, and dealt with them. And you know, there's just sort of the individuals who just immediately gravitate to just the commercial dynamic, and here's the market, and here's how we're going to go get it. Here's all the money we're going to make. And these guys aren't that way at all. These guys are, we're concerned about this country. We're concerned about the resources that are amassing on the other side. We're concerned that there's not alternatives available. We're concerned about our kids and our grandkids. The sincerity, the realistic sincerity that they're bringing to this project, I can guarantee is the real deal. And that's a rare thing, even in political undertakings. You know, people get a little cynical after a while sometimes. These guys are patriots, like you said, they're veterans, and they are out to help this country.
They want to make a difference. And, I mean, their passion's all over this thing, Michael, and that's the one takeaway I get every time I speak to them. Never have I seen, there's not been one call or one conversation where they said, oh my God, how much money can we make? Or what do you, it has never come up into the equation, not one single moment. It's all about, how do we make a difference, and how do we get people to realize what's happening? Now that's beautiful. That's inspirational. And that tells you that they're in the right place at the right time. So listen, I'm honored, really, really honored to have them here as a sponsor with us, but more so for us to help them get the word out there across our great country from sea to shining sea, that there is another path forward. We're going to spend a lot more time on these kinds of things ahead. Because one of the things I want to talk about with Michael when we get back from the pause here, too, is the denial out there and what's happening in the movement and what Republicans and more so conservatives need to do to reunite. Let's face it, there's a deficit right now and a hole. And there's a hole in, well, I'll tell you, there's a hole in a lot of hearts. People really loved number 45 in a lot of ways. And a lot of people can't believe what's really going on. It's created a vacuum in our country. And I'm not just saying that. Everybody knows it. And even the left know it. They know the charade that's been played. And I often wonder why they go along with the gag. And of course, that's another story. We're going to take a pause. We'll be back with more Viewpoint Presents in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
My fellow Americans, our mission here at AmericaOutLoud.com is clear. We're here to defend our founding values and principles at a moment when they are under unprecedented assault. And to cover the news objectively and offer intelligent commentary on the challenges we face as a nation. You can tune in and join our family of listeners 24/7 in this vital crusade. Our apps are on Apple, Android, or Alexa. Find us on iHeartRadio or our world-class media player. It is a fight for the soul of humanity. America Out Loud Talk Radio is the voice of liberty and justice for all. One of the things I'm seeing that a lot of, and I want to talk to you, I've been wanting to talk to you about this, Michael, is in the past days and weeks, with this transaction that's happened in America, which we just put out in the first part of the program, many people feel it was not an honest transaction, or let me say a transaction, you know, let's call it people, the peaceful transfer of power. And I asked Michael that question right up front, like, do you really get that sense? And, you know, I mean, let's put it, all of the window treatment and the charades didn't give anybody really that sense of what was going on. And, you know, you can only use COVID so long. In fact, we talked about up in the first hour, by the way, about the World Health Organization just coming out and saying they've been marking the numbers wrong of the people who died. That's a whole nother story. And that
That's just shocking to me.
I know. No, it's true. And we had a doctor up front on the program that we discussed all of that. And amongst that. But let me ask you this here now. I've had a lot of people in a lot of very strange messages, strange phone calls, strange videos, commentary. And the one thing I garnered from all of this, Michael, is, and I'll tell you right now, the problem is Republicans are in denial right now. And I use Republicans. You can transfer that word to conservatives or patriots or whatever. I mean, some people are all, some people are none, and some people are some. But the point being that there's a bit of denial out there for what's taken place. And a lot of people have now, there's been a purge off of Twitter, clearly. And a lot of them now have gone really kind of underground on Telegram. And they've also gone on other social media sites, such as, you know, Clout Hub. And they've gone on, there's a series of them now that are rising or trying to rise anyways. And here's the thing I'm seeing, though. There's a real denial. People think there's a percentage of people, Michael, who still believe that Trump is in charge. There's a percentage of people who believe that our military is in charge. There's a percentage of people who believe that the Insurrection Act is in play. There's a percentage of people who, and the conversations, even on Telegram, are, and what's happened is this, the vacuum created on Twitter and Facebook, both, have now gone over here. I'd almost call it like underground, but you can use whatever word you want. But they're over there in these DM sites like Telegram and other. Signal is another one. And what they're doing, Michael, and hear me on this now, because I'm really concerned. They're sitting on these programs and they're on these channels and they're on there like hours and hours all day long, feeding each other all these narratives and conversations and outrage about what's wrong in the country. And in other words, they're in the most massive echo chamber they could be, trying to feed each other. And that's all it is echo chambers, being with people who have the same theories you have, and there's no proof of any of it. But there's so much of that going on. And I don't know what to do with some of these people. And some of these people I care passionately about, but they're totally lost in the storm here. They don't know what's going on. What do you say to all that?
Sometimes that conversation just hits a wall. Let me tell you definitively, though, because, you know, I spent a long time learning these things in this kind of admittedly sometimes awkward and unusual profession. Q does not exist as a real source of internal information. All right. Discard it. I would have been more adamant about that even earlier, though I was on record saying that, you know, I put no credibility in it. A lot of Trump people did. There, you could probably do a psychological profile between the rise of conspiracy thinking and feelings of instability and insecurity in the country and world. I've noticed they tend to rise during these periods as, you know, a means of either comfort that things are going to be okay, or sometimes by way of embellishing the threats that we face. You remember all the FEMA camp rumors when Obama took off?
Exactly.
And I tell people, nobody's going in FEMA camp. Nobody's going in FEMA camps. But let me also tell you, that doesn't mean that we don't have a threat here. Well, there's no, trust the plan, okay? There was one of the deficiencies of the administration, there wasn't enough planning, okay? And Q, let me just say two things that to me are totally discrediting about it. Number one, anonymous sources hold very little value in my eyes. They're anonymous usually for a reason. If you notice, anything and everything that I say is on, you know, on the public record with my name and my career and my reputation on the line. So when I say something, that's there. Okay, I got skin in the game. This person or this man, this woman, this group, whatever it is, could be anything, anybody. It may not even be Americans. Has nothing in the game. They could disappear tomorrow. We'd never know who they were. Number two, even if you were willing to forget all that and just start looking at the track record of predictions, that's been filled with projections that did not manifest into reality. Okay, Pizzagate disproven, Hillary Clinton arrested, never happened. The list goes on and on. I mean, I haven't done the actual batting average, but it's not much higher than 50%.
So why are these people buying into these theories? Why?
Well,
what do you think?
I think it's an era of uncertainty, and they feel they're getting some insight that they wouldn't otherwise get. That's part of it. The other part of it, which I think had both a constructive and destructive component, was that they were being led to believe that, well, they weren't getting everything that they were promised in 2016 yet, that it was ultimately coming. And when you look at it, if you look at what was the ultimate grand political impact of this movement, however large it is, but it clearly had consequence, it was to be patient with Trump. You know, the trust the plan. What plan? Well, some plan somewhere somebody has, I guess. You know, I mean, the whole thing made no sense. But you could not tell people who believed in it that it was wrong. And I had many, many a conversation that just got real hostile real fast because I'm saying, look, listen to me. I mean, and listen to me and look at, you got to look at people's track records, you know, like one of the things I'm proud of is there's no formal ranking of predictions and like where they are. But if you went back when I really started in the public domain, mid 1980s, pretty long time ago now, of talking about where this country was headed, what we needed to do, I'm not sure I've gotten too many things glaringly wrong. I think, and I haven't been timid about my predictions. You know, that's the easiest thing to do. You don't make any big predictions. You don't get anything wrong. But you put your credence in people who have skin in the game, who got their name on the line, and who you know share the vision and love of the country that you share. Q will ultimately, like deep throat, find out who it was. I think it's going to end up proving very unremarkable and deflating to a lot of people. And if you go back and look at the tracker here the last 4 years, it was not a source of accuracy on many things. It was really designed to put malevolent, malicious political motives behind just about everything that was being done in government and to build Trump as understanding the totality of all of these intricacies and this design to extract it at some moment that never came, right? That last day was going to be the day, or even literally up to the 20th in the morning. People are saying, you know, there's 3 hours left. There's going to be all these arrests all over town. And there weren't going to be any arrests all over town. I mean, the deficiency of this administration, which I praised continuously for 4 years and supported on day one, was the exact opposite of what Q said. There wasn't enough planning. There wasn't enough staffing. He never got his arms around the Justice Department. He never got his arms around the intelligence community. And this administration, if the election itself was on his political appointees, they were pretty roughly split. I mean, there were many, many people that were put into this administration who opposed just about everything in the Make America Great agenda. And there were vacancies and Obama holdovers. And then you look at the way Biden's handled this. And I got, as you know, nothing positive to say about this guy or his 47-year career or what I believe are his crooked ways. But I will say this. They came in there and it was machine-like in their execution. I've been following closely what's going on. Just take the Voice of America, for instance. It's not something that would be immediately on your mind. But this place was being mismanaged for about the last 20 years. It was founded to kind of promulgate objective news and a love of America in countries where objective news is not available, and they hate America. It was and is a great idea, but like everything else, it has to be properly run and managed. And it got taken over by, you know, all of these usual forces that were actually reporting critically on the United States, and were. You know, in some cases, even engaged in relationships with the Chinese Communist Party and whatnot. And Trump didn't know that for the first, he wasn't dealing with any of that until that second or third year. But finally, they got this great guy who was like an anti-communist. They put him in. And I was watching with great admiration what I saw as these incremental improvements in moving the Voice of America, very important global communications, U.S. government agency, back into the role that it was ideally designed to fill. And I was really happy with the way it was going. Day one, they were in meeting with that guy. You're out. No, out in 2 weeks. No, we're having a goodbye party for you. No, thanks for all what you did. Give us your security pass. You're gone. To my knowledge, there is not one Trump appointee left in this entire administration of dozens upon dozens of agencies and departments and thousands upon thousands of individuals. You contrast that with how January 2017 came in. There were hugely important positions that were vacant for a long time. They had to ask Obama people to stay in for a while because they didn't have anyone to replace it. If you can recall, well, you wouldn't recall this, but it should be looked into in greater depth now. They put together a database during the transition to attract pro-Trump Make America Great employees, and they had greatagain.gov was the website. And they brought in tens of thousands of resumes of people who loved Trump and wanted to serve in his government. The server crashed several months later. And I guess I was gullible at first because I go, wow, that was a very unfortunate technical development. And I started to think, I said, that server didn't crash. That server got crashed, you know? So all these individuals who had so much to offer pretty much were kept on the outside. And, you know, even Trump, ultimately, at the end of the day, I you know, let's be honest, it would be great to be able to say, you know, I'm leaving and, you know, the swamp's not drained, but it's at least, you know, not as full as it was before I arrived. I mean, it's as full, if not fuller, than before he arrived, sadly. And not for lack of effort on his part, but I think if there's one deficiency, it was the lack of an appreciation of how many people and how many functions and how many obstructions you need to be able to overcome to execute the very laudable and ambitious mission that he had in wanting to drain the swamp.
Well, he obviously didn't go far enough. And we've seen that early on in the days where he, as you say, there were a lot of people left in powerful positions that should have never been put in. And then you look at Christopher Wray and Gina Haspel. And by the way, they're keeping Christopher Wray as head of the FBI. That's been announced already. You see that, right?
Yeah, I mean, let's take a great example. I mean, why do we have an election? You know, I mean, it's like you got the same guy running Federal Justice Department under either. I mean, why would you put that guy in charge of that department, given the proximity that he had over all of this time and the role that he had played, not in doing anything wrong, but in being part of that whole culture?
Well, it's not
telling me in 300, a country of 330 million Americans, we couldn't go out and find somebody who didn't have any of these conflicts.
Of course we could, but no, it's not about, right. I mean, they're just going along with it because that's what they all do. It's just powerful positions. There ain't any of them that stand up.
I hear this routinely from Trump supporters. I'm going to push back on it. You tell me if I'm wrong about it, Malcolm. When you say it's what they do, Donald Trump, lest anyone forget it, was president of the United States and head of state. He had all the authority to make any personnel moves that he wanted to make within the federal government, down to the most micro level, small level positions.
To your point.
Now, it's more difficult with the civil service, but even there you can make changes. But on political appointees, like an FBI director, there's really no excuse for not having someone in there who you believe is going to objectively execute and successfully execute that mission.
And he hired
DOJ.
He hired
and all of the acronym and intel agencies, which I just, I mean, do you know anybody who feels that those guys were not undermining Trump the whole time?
No, that's been one of the big, I think the single biggest problem he's had is, listen, I've called this out many times in recent days. This will go down to be very much likely one of the very biggest mistakes this presidency made. Is, you know, it's one thing to make the claim that I'm going to drain a swamp, the establishment per se. It's another thing to learn to pull that plug out and let them go. And when you keep all the senior staff and you keep even more so the middle management in play, you don't make those necessary changes, then there's no way you're going to be draining anything. And if you remember back throughout all that time, how many times things were leaked out to the New York Times and the Washington Post and NBC.
From the beginning to the end.
How many times did that happen throughout the entire damn administration? And they kept looking at us, well, we don't know who did. In fact, a lot of those things came from the West Wing. And so he was cluttered with misfits who were only out to get him. And I think they're very culpable of that. And no, they didn't drain the swamp, Michael. They enraged the swamp. They enraged it and engaged it.
Because they didn't support him. They didn't support him. Let's just be honest. And you know, it seems unfair and maybe counterproductive retroactively to go back and start naming names. But the list is long. You would need a pretty big bookshelf right now to just take all of the books of ex-Trump employees trashing Trump. And the millions of dollars that these people made. I can't think of anything more disgusting to me And I almost believe you would think that ethics and human decency would prevent, but apparently not. There almost should be like laws against this. I assume there's First Amendment rights, but you know, you really, when you go in and serve an administration, I think your loyalty to that administration has got to guide your behavior after you leave. So for instance, as you likely have been able to tell, but have not heard from me this directly, I mean, George H.W. Bush, I supported, I liked, I worked for, I had, if I could name his accomplishments, and you're not going to hear me disparage him. But, you know, in the list of figures who really influenced my political development and who I have had the most enthusiasm about, you know, you've sorted down, you know, he was the best option going, and he did a good job at that moment of time, and he made a whole bunch of mistakes, different types of mistakes. But this mistake is almost the toughest one to take, because people like me and many others would have gladly made that clear, and yet the voices in his ear for 4 years, all the way back to the transition, all the way back to that posse of people that was guiding those early appointments, was to embrace the swamp. Don't keep the swamp at bay.
Mm-hmm. No.
And then that started snowballing, and you can't unravel that.
There's a lot to talk about on that topic. I mean, there's no doubt. This is going to be, to me, an ongoing theme as to what went wrong and how it went wrong. And right now, when you see the establishment be, they're empowered right now. They're empowered. They're in pursuit. And they're at the head of the class right now. And you're seeing that right now. I mean, as I always say to you, as the levers of government, you can hear the giant sucking sound coming from DC. As they flip over and the new people come in, you're going to see. And the one thing about the Democrats per se, they don't, you know, they're so infiltrated throughout the establishment and throughout Washington, they're not going to have the same problem. And it's hard to fathom sometimes where these people come from or why they see this as an America that they want to embrace and they want to support. But yet that's what they see. And that comes back to the divide in our nation we talk about frequently, my friends. Well, let me just give you a couple of thoughts here as we get to the end of the program here on Viewpoint. And, you know, everything you're listening to now on Sunday morning on Viewpoint, you'll catch on podcast after 2 p.m. Sunday afternoon. You can get us on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, iHeart, all of them. And that's the place. And then on demand, and you can get this throughout the week as well. Occasionally, we run an encore here and there as well on it, but the best place to be is on Sunday morning. This program is at 11 o'clock. Viewpoint this Sunday is 10. Two great hours of talk radio excellence. And that's the place to connect with us right there. 10 o'clock Sunday morning. Viewpoint this Sunday. And then Viewpoint Presents with Michael Johns here with us at 11. We replay later in the day at Encore, my friends, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. So connect with us there, and we'll continue on with the message here. Thank you again for being part of the journey here. It's time to get involved and get loud.